introduce Joshua Shea. Joshua, I met Joshua actually through LinkedIn, and was sharing what I was doing as far as with my private practice goes and as far as my YouTube channel. And I came across his book, and it looks like it was something that, as guys, we don't talk about. It's something that's, kind of swept under the rug. We kind of do by ourselves. And I just thought it would be great to have you on my podcast and kind of share your story. And I want to start off. Well, I want you to go ahead and introduce yourself and talk a little bit about your book, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. Well, my name is Joshua Shea. I am currently a porn addiction educator and author. I have been sober now for 6 years, relapse free. But I was a pornography addict for about 25 years. I was also an alcoholic for almost the same amount of time. Entered recovery in, I'm sure we'll talk about that story, entered recovery in early 2014. Essentially, I'm just trying to make the world a better place or give it some resources, because when I had to first face my pornography addiction, there really weren't a lot of resources for porn addicts. There was some academic texts, and there were the, here's how you get healthy right now texts. But I wasn't really ready for either of them. I just needed something that I could look through. So released in 2018 was my memoir about my descent, especially the last few years into pornography addiction. And then at the beginning of December 2019, I released a new book. I teamed with a licensed marriage and family therapist named Tony Overbay. And we wrote a book called He's a Porn Addict, Now What? An expert and a former addict to answer your questions. And we wrote this one with the partner in mind, because porn addiction is unlike other addictions in how it affects the partner. A woman, which is generally the partner, it doesn't always have to be, but a woman is generally the partner of a porn addict. She doesn't ask herself if, what she did to cause her husband's gambling problem. Or she doesn't wonder if she's not enough in the bedroom because he has a heroin problem. Yeah. But porn addiction and sex addiction both cause a lot of trauma, specifically called betrayal trauma, for the partner of a porn or sex addict. So we wanted to help guide them through that, because I found after writing my first book, I thought it would be all addicts contacting me. Yeah. And it was about half and half. I got so many partners contacting me, it just shocked me. And much like my situation when I first faced addiction, there aren't a lot of resources. There are a few books from women who went through it individually, but there's not much from professionals, and there's nothing from the addict side of things. So we tried to create a resource for women, very easily read Q&A, about 65 questions that we both answer from each side of the equation. And so far it's getting really good reviews from both the medical and mental health side of things and the partner side of things for women who have become using it. So really happy with how it turned out, how it's being received.
That's great. There's just not an overall enough resources for men. And that was one of the big things why I started this private practice and started this YouTube channel, is that there's not a lot, and just want to thank you for, sharing your story and being such an open book about it. So why don't we just start with, how did your life look before everything started coming down, and just kind of how it got to that point? So
yeah, well, I'd love to say this will be my one ramble, but this will just be my first ramble. I am kind of textbook when it comes to pornography addiction. When I was young, there was abuse at the hands of a babysitter. It was sexual, it was physical, it was emotional. And what I really did in that household when I was 4, 5, 6 years old is that I learned the coping skill of just survive to the next day. Say what you have to say, do what you have to do. I learned, how to teach myself to disconnect. It was where I kind of learned just go ahead and do what you need to do and say sorry instead of asking permission. You know, all of these kind of maladaptive survival skills I developed as a, you know, four or five-year-old boy in this place. And while those may be the kind of skills that can get a five-year-old boy through the day, they're not the kind of skills that can get a 35-year-old man through the day. And anyway, I was eventually, you know, went out of that house, you know, had nothing to do with the abuse. It's just that she stopped taking care of children. When I was about 11 years old, my cousin showed me hardcore pornography for the first time. I think it was Penthouse or Hustler magazine. And I just knew I discovered something. It was unlike any sensation I've ever had. And I'm not talking about, you know, oh, there are sexy people on the page here. This was a, you know, light from above. Oh, my goodness. I have just found the panacea. I have just found the answer. I don't know what's going to happen in my life. But when it gets bad, when it gets stressful, when there's anxiety, I think I just found something that I can cope with everything in my life. And, you know, and this is, you know, 11, 12 year old boy. The only other time I've ever felt this kind of tickle in my brain for the first time was when I was 14 or 15 years old and I got drunk for the first time. And all of a sudden it was like, wow, I see why people, you know, use this stuff. This is fantastic. I'm a better version of myself. I feel good. I'm on top of the world. This is not how I usually feel. And this is fantastic. So, you know, when people say, when did you know you were an addict? I tell them, it was within 15 minutes of seeing porn, and it was within 15 minutes of drinking alcohol the very first time. In high school, you know, I was a popular kid. I did well grade-wise, but a lot of days after school, when, you know, I didn't have my license yet, I would get on my bike, and this was, you know, late 80s, early 90s. I would ride my bike to the video store, and this was a store that didn't really care about anybody's age, so I rented two adult films every day, and then I found a convenience store that would sell beer, and I bought a couple loose beers, and would go home, have a couple beers, and watch a movie before my parents got back from work. And then after everybody went to bed in my house, I'd drink the other beer or two that I saved and watch the other movie. And that was kind of my life for a long time. I found myself getting lost in work. 17, 18 years old, I got a job at a newspaper and absolutely fell in love with it. You know, we could talk about workaholism being an issue off and on, but work made me feel worthwhile. Work was probably how I mostly defined myself, you know, over the next 15 years, but I did well at work. I ended up meeting a great woman and married her. We had a couple kids, but the porn and the drinking were always there. She knew about the drinking. She didn't care that much as long as it was at home. You know, I wasn't an angry drunk. I wasn't an abusive drunk. I was more sit there, be quiet, and watch TV drunk. And so didn't bother her too much. She knew I looked at a little bit of porn here and there, but she had no idea the extent of it. You know, I had these two things as crutches, and nobody knew just how bad the addictions were. When things were going well in my life, they might subside. When things were going bad, they would definitely spike. In my mid-30s, I finally made the decision after working in journalism for about 12 years that I wanted to start my own magazine. Here in Central Maine, where I live, and it was an overnight success. My five-year business plan that I sketched out was done in about 4 months, and while that's a good problem to have, still a problem, because I'm not a businessman. I can hide the fact I'm not a bad businessman when you throw loads of money at me, but that's the only way I can really hide it. After about 3-4 years of running this magazine, and I'd done other things in town. I launched one of the largest film festivals in New England while I was running the magazine. I ran for local office and served on my city council while I was running the magazine. I was really the quote-unquote pillar of the community, local celebrity, whatever you want to call it. And so about 4 years into the magazine operating, I start noticing that our revenue starts to plateau, and then it starts to slowly go down. And this is because after, you know, 4 years, nobody sees me as this plucky underdog anymore. You know, I'm this guy who's doing well. And a lot of businesses recognized that, gee, we tried advertising there for 3 or 4 years. Now let's put our money elsewhere and see how that can work. Or this is just not working for us. Let's try elsewhere. And other businesses, the economy was still bad. So other businesses were not coming up to kind of fill that void. So I started getting very nervous because while the revenues were dropping, our expenses were still going up. And I looked and saw that, you know, one day I realized we probably had about 6 months to a year left to go until something turned around, unless something turned around. And ultimately, this is where the story takes its big turn. I decided to pull myself off of my bipolar medication that I'd been on since I was probably about 22, 23.
Wow.
So you're talking about, you know, 10, 12 years on this medication. I thought, and this is, I recognize now in retrospect that I was romancing the energy it gave me. I was romancing the mania and the creativity. And I thought if I could tap into that, I could save the magazine. Well, that was just stupid. I ended up, you know, after 2 or 3 weeks of medication coming out of my system, my alcoholism absolutely exploded. I started drinking in the morning. I would always make sure that I went and had a liquid lunch. And if we were doing, you know, afternoon meetings, it was always at the brew pub just down the street. And then at night, I actually, for the first time ever, and I'd never been a fan of hard liquor, I stopped drinking beer very late at night, and I moved over to tequila. At the same time, you know, looking at pornography, I was generally looking at, you know, just kind of vanilla stuff. And then that, you know, the content got more extreme. And then after the content got more extreme, I made the jump over to chat rooms and started actually interacting. And I was pulling this catfishing scam where basically I played a video of a good looking younger guy, you know, some guy in his mid 20s who looked like he was typing away. He'd be talking to the women on the screen while I was off to the side doing research, because I know how to ask certain questions to get a lot of information out of people, having been an investigative journalist for a long time. So I could manipulate them, and I manipulated them to, you know, take their clothes off and manipulated them to do things to themselves. And that was really about power. You know, I learned that later on too. And, you know, if you want to get into that weekend, that was about power. That was about control. So I did this for several months. And on the morning of March 14th, or March 20th, 2014, I saw two unmarked cars in a van pull up to my house. And, you know, you do not have to be a fan of cop shows to know exactly what an unmarked car looks like. And when a bunch of guys jump out of their vehicles in their, you know, navy blue golf jackets, you're like, okay, this is something. I thought somebody had died. I went to the door, and the officer standing in the front had a piece of paper, and I was able to just pull words off of it immediately and recognize what they were there for. As I did that, he said, you know, we have a search warrant. We believe you have some underage pornography on your computer, which, you know, floored me. And, you know, they had a search warrant, so you have to let them in the house. And I let them in, and they basically in the next 15 minutes laid out the case, and they had me cooked. In November of 2013, they showed me that I made the horrible, horrible mistake of talking to a teenager online and treating her like I did the overage woman or legal woman that I talked to, and got her to take off her clothes and do things to herself. And I couldn't say I didn't do it, because I clearly did. And, you know, this is where, you know, I always try to underline before I go forward that, you know, I don't blame her, obviously. I don't blame the addiction either. I know the addiction got to a point where cause and effect were not necessarily working properly in my mind, and I didn't necessarily understand consequences in my mind. But I know that I still understood that, you know, there were 15 and 16 year old girls who look 25 and 26 and vice versa. And just because you've got an addiction doesn't mean that you can show bad judgment. The reality is, it's my fault because I pulled myself off of my bipolar medication. I knew that I had a medical condition, and I just neglected it for another reason, but that doesn't matter. Yeah. I neglected my mental health, and this is where it led. It was 2 years before I was between being arrested and being sentenced. I spent that 2 years, 10 weeks alcohol rehab, 7 weeks porn and sex rehab. I read everything that I could find on addiction. There was very little about porn addiction. I did lots of therapy ultimately I ended up in 6 months in jail. But when I came out, I decided it's time to make a difference. And that's what I've been trying to do in the 3.5 years since.
And how did you make that turn? Where, I mean, I mean, you can kind of go two ways on that. You can either deny, which we often see. We can use, you know, kind of the blame card. Why did you decide to like, okay, I need to own this. I need to do it.
Well, the day after I was arrested, I went to my lawyer's office with my wife and my father. The lawyer was a acquaintance of my father. That's how I met him for the first time. And his first question to us, or to me, was, is this a litigation game or is this a sentencing game? And I said, it's a sentencing game. You know, there's no reason to try to fight this. And he said, okay, well, do you have any drug or alcohol problems? And I said, no. And my father and my wife both said, oh, yes, he does. And I said, well, you know, if you want to send me to rehab, if that's going to help with the judge, yeah, let's do it. Yeah. And my lawyer said, wait, no, stop. Here's the thing. You did something horrible. You did something horrible because you're sick. And whether you want to admit it or not, you need some help. Here's the thing. This legal stuff will all be over someday. Whether you go to jail for 3 days or 3 months or 3 years, whether you're on probation for 10 months or 10 years, it doesn't matter, because one day this will all be over. Do you want to be that same guy when this is all over? Because this is just going to happen to you again and probably happen worse. And it was like, oh, okay, well, send me off to rehab then. And I'll admit, I went and I was still somewhat hesitant. But after about a week, and I thought I'd be there for 4 weeks. I ended up spending 10 weeks at my first rehab for alcohol. And after about a week, it just dawned on me, you know, they're talking exactly about me. I had never listened to anything about alcoholism before. They're talking exactly about me. And then in my last couple of weeks when I was there, after I embraced the program and really started living it and recognizing the changes I need to make and starting to recognize that, you know, how this was rooted in trauma, my caseworker had me meet with a friend of his who was a CSAT, certified sex addiction therapist, who worked in Palm Springs off campus. So I went and visited this guy twice a week for my last 3 weeks there. And he was the one who made me recognize that porn addiction was a thing. I had never even, I don't know that I even heard about it before. I thought that the decisions I made around pornography were usually because I was drunk. Or because I was horny or whatever it was. But I didn't even know porn addiction was a thing. And this guy helped me, number one, start to unlock some of these memories that were surfacing around the time when everything was falling apart. And he made me recognize porn addiction as a thing. And it actually predated my drinking by several years. So the alcohol rehab worked so well that I really embraced the idea of going to a sex and porn rehab, because my lawyer was right. I couldn't be the same guy. I had very publicly been shamed and knew that my life was going to have to be completely different on a professional level. I knew my life was going to have to be different on a personal level, because I had really kind of ostracized my wife and kids the last 6 months to a year that I was in my addiction. So if those two things had to change, everything had to change. So I had to, I really embraced recovery and said to myself, you know, this is my shot. Most people, like I said, it was 2 years between arrest and sentencing. my full-time job was getting better. And most people never get that luxury in life. Most people aren't lucky enough to have the resources or access to the resources to get that kind of help. And I did. So I didn't take it lightly. And I decided that I was going to really try to get myself better. And then once happened, like I mentioned in jail, I decided it was time to give back.
Was it, because I mean, you sound like you knew the attorney, like he was kind of a family friend. Him taking that time to like, just to be honest and direct with you, was that a big kind of was it a huge thing for you, do you think? Or do you think that was just the situation?
It was a much bigger thing in retrospective. And once I got to rehab and started thinking about it and started recognizing I was an alcoholic, at the moment, I was still in my head thinking, whatever's good for the judge. Mm. Because you got to remember, 24 hours earlier, I'd been arrested. When I woke up that morning of March 20th, that's not what I thought was going to happen to my day. I didn't think I'd have to call my wife out of work. I didn't think that I'd be dodging TV cameras. Wow. I didn't think I'd be having to explain to my parents what happened.
Yeah.
So, there was still a huge shock factor going on. And I remember that meeting, but there was a few days there where I was just kind of numb because so many surreal things were happening around me that you never think you'll be a part of.
And so there has to be some sort of like where like that, you know, you're saying like numbing and kind of like you just wanted to get out of it. When did it switch to like, man, I really need to get my life together, like I need to be like, what was that? Was it in rehab? Was it
the conversations? That first week at rehab, I kind of just said I'm going to play along. And then I don't know exactly how the shift happened, but it was like, okay, this is real. They're talking too much about my patterns. They're talking too much about my behaviors for this not to be me. I know they didn't structure this program to just be for me. This is clearly for all alcoholics. And if they're describing me, maybe I'm an alcoholic. I also, I also knew that, three of my four grandparents were alcoholics. And so, whether you believe that it travels in families or not, there was the behavior there. It's been a gradual thing. And it's one of those things, I don't think it hits you quite over the head, but sitting there between lectures and classes at rehab, talking to people who maybe they had meth problems or heroin problems, but sitting and talking to other people who had chemical dependency, that was also just so helpful, and hearing other people's stories. And, it's rehab, both alcohol and the sex porn one, were such amazing transformative experiences for me because it just removed me from my environment and let me focus on me at a deeper level than I ever have before. And I think that was, you just have these aha moments, and the aha moments, they add up and kind of turn you into a different person.
Yeah. And I think that's what it sounds like. It sounds like it was a lot of, well, that's kind of true. Well, yeah, it's kind of, and they just kind of like snowball from there, right? And that's what it kind of sounds like. I mean, to be able to be vulnerable and being able to be in that kind of setting was been very powerful for you and for a lot of people that go to rehab. Who helped you during this journey? I mean, was there a lot of, who would you say as help guide you
number one was my wife, the support of my wife. When I was bailed out of jail, she came and bailed me out. I called her to come get me. The police, he put me in his front seat of his car, gave me my phone, said, call whoever you need. He recognized I was no threat. And I called my wife and I just said, hey, the police just came and they found underage pornography on my computer. I can explain this to you when you pick me up. Get $500, meet me at the sheriff's office. When they bailed me out, they said your wife is, or when they let me go, they said your wife is in the car out front. So I went into our Jeep and I said, hey, hold on. Oh, just don't say anything. I want you to know that I will not fight you on a divorce. You can have the house, the cars, the kids, anything you want. This is way beyond anything I should expect you to deal with. So I'm cool on that. And she just said, I just want to know one thing. Did it involve little kids? And I was like, oh God, no. It involved, you know, a teenage girl who I didn't even recognize was a teenage girl at the time. You know, no excuse, but I didn't know. And she's like, okay, well, you know, we've recognized you've not been healthy for a long time, and we've not been able to get through to you.
Yeah.
So let's just take this a day at a time right now and see what happens. And I know that had I not gone and done the recovery thing, had I not done well, had I relapsed, had I not cared about recovery and not taken it seriously, that she would have left. But she saw me trying very hard to improve who I was and supported me through that. So that was number one. Number two was the therapist who I still have to this day. I actually met her for the first time about 3 days after I was arrested. I hadn't had a therapist in 2 or 3 years. I'd been to therapy before, but hadn't had one for a long time. My doctor referred me to her. I'd never had a female therapist before, never had one that was close to my age. I think she's 3 years older, and she was just the best thing in the world. I spent, you know, those first 2 years, I spent, you know, sometimes 3 to 5 hours a week with her. And the many people who I met at my rehabs helped me so, so much, you know, learn different aspects about myself. And you know, yeah, it's one of those, it takes a village thing where, yeah. you know, there are people who are dead now from different things who, just because they sat there and told me their stories about using heroin, that, you know, that helped me see certain things in a different light. It's like you said, it's a snowball effect. It's a lot of little things. That's why, you know, people get into recovery. There's no magic bullet. There's nothing anybody's going to say. It is a long climb uphill. It is a tough climb uphill. If you told me at the very beginning how hard this was going to be, you know, I would have been scared. Thankfully, I have this streak of optimism. I have this streak of naiveness that I've carried through life. And I like any other project, I barreled into it. And getting healthy was my project for 2 years.
Wow. And so now you're on this kind of path to kind of bring awareness to what are some of the things that you're doing? I mean, I've done some research on you, but I really want you to explain, like...
Yeah. Well, I wrote my first book in jail. I actually wrote it into composition books using those little miniature golf pencils. That's all they would give us to write with. So I filled 5 notebooks with about 100 pencils. That, like I said, that book came out January 2018. That was the same time that I launched my website, recoveringpornaddict.com. On there, I frequently update with different blog postings, articles that I write that have to do with recovery, that have to do with my time that I was an addict, and then just sometimes philosophy surrounding addiction in general. There's a resources page there, lists all my podcast and radio interviews and TV interviews that I've done, so people can go and, you know, learn more about my story and get a little bit deeper if they have a certain aspect they want to hear about it. And then after I launched that, after the book came out, I started doing a lot of just casual one-on-one advising with people online. And I don't have the schooling and the expertise to do the kind of stuff that you do. And I found what I was doing was mostly, if I was talking to an addict, I was mostly nudging them towards getting real therapy, explaining what that would be like, because they were either, you know, scared or embarrassed. And I think I was the first person they'd ever talked to who didn't make them feel shameful. And, you know, they could tell me exactly what they did. And it was like, okay, whatever. You know, you like this certain kind of porn. That's cool.
Yeah.
You know, but it's wrecking your life. So let's, you know, talk about how you're going to get better. And then I get, like I mentioned earlier, what surprised me was so many partners contacted me, and I started helping them out a little bit and trying to get them to recognize that it wasn't their fault, and teaching them, you know, there are these things called boundaries that you need to set and that you have to enforce, which was a foreign idea for a lot of them. And I was just taking this from what I learned as an addict. I ended up meeting Tony actually through his podcast, and we, you know, we shared this moment where I was talking about how I feel a little weird when I'm trying, you know, I don't want to give real hardcore mental health advice because I don't want to say the wrong thing because I don't have the expertise. And he also mentioned, but he's on the other side of things, where how many times he's sat there as a therapist and had either the addict or the partner bark at him, well, you don't know how I feel. You've never been through this. And that was when I kind of, you know, when we were mentioning this, that's when I kind of like, I want to write a second book. What do I want to do? Here's an idea. So as I was working on that book with Tony over the last 2 years, I developed a couple of presentations that I've done at libraries and churches, a couple of civic groups, talking about porn addiction, not just my story, but also talking about what a massive problem this is going to be. It is in society, and it's going to be in society if we don't address it. I mean, I call the presentation the addiction, you know, nobody will talk about, you know, based off my first book, but it really is something nobody's talking about.
And I think we need to open up that discussion. I think we can do that now of like where it's head is. I mean, especially with VR and definitely, like, oh god, it's like a different level that you know, because it seems to like any kind of technology will it's kind of led by porn, right? Porn and is, the internet,
Porn and pro wrestling are the two things that are always on the cutting edge of technology through history.
Wow, that's interesting. So so this is my concern, is that we're having a lot of kids, you know, the younger generation, that they don't have the social skills to even like have a conversation with the opposite sex, or even talk about you know, secrets or stuff that they're ashamed of, and now they just have, you know, they have whatever they need in the, you know, in the palm of their hand.
Right.
And so we kind of see it. It's kind of on the wall, you know, like what's kind of coming. What do you see that we can do for this? Like, what do you kind of see that?
Well, the stat that I always quote, which I think really drives home exactly where we stand right now, is something that the Barna Group, which is a consulting organization, came up with in 2017. They found that 32% of men between the ages of 18 and 30 have said that they either believe they have a bad problem with pornography or they have a full-on addiction to it. Wow. That's essentially one out of three men under 30 years old.
Yeah.
Now, what do we do about them? Honestly, I don't know. I think maybe the same kind of recovery stuff we did with me, maybe, but I don't know. What we have to do is think about the younger ones, because that's where we're going to stop it. And, you know, parents have to, I'm sorry, this is the truth that these, you know, today in 2020, we have to start talking about pornography to our kids the way that we start talking, the way that we talk about drugs or alcohol or cigarettes or how to cross the street. It can be completely age appropriate. You know, you can tell a 6-year-old, make sure that, you know, nobody ever looks down there, and you don't look any down there for anybody, you know, no matter what their age is. And you don't let anybody take a picture of you down there under your bathing suit, and you don't take a picture under anybody's bathing suit. And as they get older, you can make it a little more technical, but kids don't know what porn is. So they're not going to be freaked out by it. They're not, you know, kids want direction. Kids want to know right from wrong. So you can make it age appropriate. And then my belief is that the biggest way that we're going to fight this is by taking our 13 and 14 year old boys and, for lack of a better term, absolutely scaring the hell out of them. Because what we need to do is we need to start talking much more loudly about porn-induced erectile dysfunction. I truly believe that the 13 and 14 year old boys in this world who are looking at porn or looking at a lot of porn, they probably mostly want a real girlfriend. They're not looking at this at addictive levels yet. They're probably not looking at it even obsessive levels yet. It can get there if they're not careful. But what they want is right now, that is a surrogate for a girlfriend. The way that most adults look at porn, it's a surrogate for having sex that evening. Mm-hmm. It ends with the orgasm, and that's what it's for. I believe that if we can tell these 13 and 14-year-old boys about porn-induced erectile dysfunction, that we can probably scare them a bit into treating pornography the way that they treat drugs or cigarettes or alcohol, and that they don't engage in it at a young age. And when they're old enough to engage in it, they have the education behind it to not make mistakes. You know, tell a 14-year-old boy about an 18 and 19-year-old guy who has an absolutely beautiful girlfriend, but he can't perform with her. He can't have sex with her because he's seen so much porn. It's basically fried his brain. I was talking to somebody the other day. This is the first time that I'd heard this, and it makes sense, but it's a sad testament. I was talking to a guy who, again, beautiful girlfriend, 20, 21 years old, and the only way that he can reach an orgasm with her is if porn is playing behind her while they're intimate, or if she's in the other room on their other computer and they're doing it cam to cam. Because that treats it as pornography for him.
Wow.
That makes sense, but it's really, like I said, a sad testament. So I think some of these stories need to start being told to 13 and 14-year-old boys. And you know what? No, we won't, defeat pornography this way. It'll always be there. That's why I don't try to fight the pornography industry, because that's silly. Yeah. But it's education. If they go and start looking at pornography at a later age, they have the more developed brain. They can make better decisions. Hopefully, no kind of addiction has grabbed hold of them then. And will there be some addicts? Of course there will be some addicts. There are still drug addicts. There are still people who chain smoke. But you can't tell me that anybody who got into chain smoking didn't know that it was bad for them. They knew it was bad for them when they took it up. Nowadays, these kids don't know that porn can be bad for them. And that's what we need to warn them about. And that's the only way that I see that we're going to bring these numbers down. Because if we don't deal with it, these 30-year-olds become 40, they become 50, they become 60. And then you've got, a country where one out of two to one out of three men are addicted to pornography. And what does that world look like?
Yeah. I mean, and it's just scary because they're, these kids are raised with a screen in front of their face. And that's probably one of their first introductions, when we were younger, it was different. It was like, you had to go through like move mountains to find some.
Oh yeah, but now absolutely. Scrambled stuff on TV or find a magazine in the woods. And and right now the most disgusting, freaky, exotic, weird stuff that you and I couldn't even find or would know where to find is a 3-word Google search away.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I think it's definitely having that conversation early and treating it like a drug addiction, like any kind of addiction, because anytime a guy isolates themselves and they're doing something that's not where it's kind of a way to kind of not deal with their issues, it's going to become addictive, this is my getaway, and then it turns into and it goes into a bigger deal. But and I think maybe the past like 10 years, I'm guessing, where it's been a little more mainstream, I guess, where it's a little more like the taboo has kind of been lowered. Well, I don't know if that's me or
it's because those 13 and 14 year old kids who got hooked on pornography back in the very 2005 2006, they're now starting to have kids. They're they don't know a world before the internet. The world before the internet, you now have to be over 30 to remember that. And that's what the generation is. So you have a generation of parents who grew up on this stuff, who don't know how to raise the next generation of kids who are going to be seeing this stuff in even more extreme ways, we can assume, over the next 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's if we can't start talking about pornography, how the heck are we ever going to start talking about pornography addiction? And we need to be proactive. You know, I don't like to belittle the opioid crisis or anything, but
we knew
in the mid 80s that, you know, that heroin was a problem.
Yeah.
You know, we knew in the mid 80s that people were abusing Vicodin. Just listen to rap music from back then and you can tell you hear a lot of that, but we didn't really care because it wasn't a part of regular mainstream polite society.
Yeah.
And now just about every single one of us knows somebody who has been touched by opioids. Yeah. And that's because we didn't do anything. Now we're pouring tons of money into the problem, which is fantastic, but it's 30 years too late. And I'm trying to tell people, instead of being reactive like we were to opioids, let's be proactive with pornography.
Yeah, this is such a huge thing with men in relationships, and you see it with, you know, with a lot of men. It's just an isolation thing where it starts off as a getaway, and then it starts sooner than that, but it's just something where they don't have to deal with life, you know, with their children, with their wife, and I think it's just having that conversation with your spouse, if you're married, of this, you know, and talking about boundaries, talking about you know, where it can go. I mean, it sounds like it could easily slide this way.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, you would never sit down with your wife or your husband and say, okay, well, let's just not tell them about drugs, or let's just not tell them about drinking or smoking.
Yeah.
And even if you're the kind of neglectful parent that doesn't do that, the schools now and the health classes in seventh and eighth grade, you know, they cover that kind of stuff. What's it going to take for a 30-minute talk about pornography in a health class in seventh grade? I think just that could have a giant impact on the next generation.
Yeah.
But, oh my God, you're going to bring up the P word in school? No, we can't talk about porn. The best thing for us to do is just bury our heads in the sand. And it's like, no, look at the opioid thing. We did it that time, and this is what happens. So, you know, let's not have half the men under 60 years old be porn addicts by the time it's 2050.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, I want to thank you for your time and just sharing your story. And I can't thank you enough. And so I just want to thank you.
No problem. And thank you for the time. Like I said, there are a lot of people who are scared to talk about this. And until more people like you are going to give platforms, you know, it's going to be a problem. So, you know, thank you for giving me this time. It takes two sides to do this.
Great. Thank you.